Apologies for the late start. The Rules Committee was not, we were not expecting that when this committee was scheduled. We're going to go, I told Senator Bonoff if she can keep her bill to 7.5 minutes, we'll let her go first because she's got a lot of people here.
So, Kate, come up, please. Bill Grant.
Go ahead. Welcome to the committee, Senator Bonoff, Senate File 2296.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This bill, members, ought to be familiar to you. Last year, we passed a law that said for a particular section of my district, if Xcel was going to pursue putting a 135K voltage power line in people's backyards, they had to explore a distribution alternative first. After that bill passed, we were in the middle of a PUC process and ended up over the summer and fall having hearings where upwards of 500 community members came to testify why it did not work to have these power lines in their backyards. Xcel chose to request to withdraw their filing. Unfortunately, if that happens, if they put forward a new proposal, they wouldn't be bound by the same law because the law identified the filing number. So as an insurance measure, this bill says that if there's a new filing, it would simply have to be bound by the same criteria that we passed last year in law. And I do want to acknowledge in the audience an entire group of Plymouth who just heard yesterday was up on the agenda, and they're all wearing little stickers. If they could just raise their hand. That's how important it is to this community. They rented a bus and came the very next day. So that completes my testimony in my 7 minutes. And now I'd like to ask one of the neighborhood spokespersons, Kate McBride.
Welcome to the committee, Ms. McBride. Please identify yourself and go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Senators, thank you for this opportunity to testify today in support of Senate File 2296. My name is Kate McBride, and I'm a Plymouth resident and a member of the Western Plymouth Neighborhood Alliance. The Alliance is a group of citizens in the Plymouth area formed because of a mutual concern about the proposal by Xcel Energy to install a 115 kV high voltage transmission line through our neighborhoods. Throughout the past 2.5 years, hundreds of Plymouth residents have shown up hearing after hearing, unified in their concern about the installation of this transmission line. They've written to the Department of Commerce, the administrative law judge, and to many of you, as you may recall, last year. They've stayed committed, engaged, and concerned. We were so grateful to the legislature when it passed the Hollydale bill last session. We felt it was going to give us a fair shot at challenging Xcel at the Certificate of Need administrative hearing that was originally scheduled for the end of last year. We had expert witnesses and hundreds of citizens weighed in at the public hearings, all urging that the area's energy needs could be met by an identified and available distribution alternative. We were ready to go when Xcel unexpectedly withdrew its application before the evidentiary hearing was to take place. In its petition to withdraw, Xcel acknowledged that the route was problematic and that it was not widely supported. While it made those concessions, it nevertheless stated that there remains a need for additional infrastructure and that it intends to return with a new proposal. The citizens of Plymouth are admittedly concerned that this may mean that Xcel will return unburdened by the limitations of the Hollydale Law, that all will be for naught, and that the citizens who collectively have dedicated thousands of hours on this will have to start from scratch. We urge you to pass Senate File 2296 out of committee to prevent Xcel from circumventing the Hollydale Law and to require it in any future filings to prove by clear and convincing evidence that there is no feasible and available distribution alternative to any proposed transmission line. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. McBride. Any questions from the committee? And did somebody from the department wish to comment on the bill? Anybody else?
I believe Mr. Grant would like to.
Mr. Grant here. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Bill Grant for the Department of Commerce, and I really didn't have any remarks planned. I'd be happy to answer any questions the committee might have.
Is there any questions from members of the committee? And did Xcel want to comment on the bill?
Who said that?
Mr. Grant?
Mr. Chairman, we will be making comments in a before the Public Utilities Commission over the course of the next several weeks, asking that they look and have Xcel look at a demand-side management and distribution-level alternative in this proceeding as an alternative to any high-voltage line. Since those remarks haven't been prepared yet, I don't have anything further to say about it than that.
Thank you. Any other questions from committee or discussion? Did Xcel wish to comment or not?
There's no
comment. No. Okay, is there any motion from member of the committee?
I'll move it.
Senator Eaton moves that Senate file 2296 be recommended to pass. Is there further discussion on that motion? Not all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
For members of the committee, I've talked with Senator Saxog and Senator Dibble. Senator Dibble is not presenting his bill today, and Senator Saxog is going to be presenting his for informational purposes because there's some issues I've heard from several others we want to make sure both those bills get a little more looking at. But the bioeconomy bill biofuels bill has some witnesses who are here and going to present and so on. And anyway, Senator Saxog, welcome to the committee. And if you can bring up your witnesses, we look forward to hearing from you.
Well, I thought that was communal water. Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and yes, you and I did have a discussion about the informational nature of the hearing today, and I'm assuming that there's a commitment here too the concerns be brought forward, or with the concerns being brought forward, that we would have another hearing prior to the deadline.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Senator Saxog, we're planning to do that next week. Yes.
All right, that's very fair, and thank you. So anyway, Mr. Chair and members, today we're presenting Senate File 2101. This bill establishes four programs in the Department of Agriculture for renewable chemicals and advanced biofuels. With me today is Brennan Jordan, Vice President of the Great Plains Initiative, and Kathleen Schuler, Healthy Kids and Family Program Director of Conservation Minnesota. And they're going to explain the bill in more detail and help answer any questions. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Mr. Jordan.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Jordan.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I am Brendan Jordan, Vice President at the Great Plains Institute. I represent the Bioeconomy Coalition of Minnesota. This is a multi-stakeholder group advocating for growing bioindustries in the state. You should have a handout in your packet that lists our members on page 2, but it is it's a group of members that you don't always see together on the same page. It's environmental community, forestry, agriculture, industry, and other groups. And we're proud to represent that coalition that's been working together for several years to develop a path forward to help grow this important industry for the state. I want to emphasize, keeping my testimony relatively short, I know that this is a busy hearing, want to emphasize some of the benefits of the program. It would secure technology leadership for Minnesota in a strategic area. Minnesota has had more than $200 million in venture capital investment in the renewable chemicals space, more than 200 patents. This also builds on existing advantages that we have. It helps to build on the foundation of the ethanol industry and forest products industry. It does commercialize a new low-carbon fuel technology that has been a priority nationally and statewide for many years. Cellulosic biofuels reduce greenhouse gas at least 50% relative to gasoline, sometimes more. It helps create safer and greener consumer products, and Kathleen will talk about that. Finally, and very importantly, this is will be a great economic boom for the state. We did commission some work with the University of Minnesota Extension to develop a, you know, kind of a return on investment for the state. If the state did create a program to create incentives for production of renewable chemicals and advanced biofuels, what would the state get out of the deal? You have some data, again, in your handout, but we estimate the program would cost the state, once it scales up, between $9 and $23 million per year, which is a significant amount of money, no question. But according to analysis by the University of Minnesota, a scaled-up program would result in at least 14 new facilities producing renewable chemicals and advanced biofuels with permanent annual economic output of nearly $900 million and more than 3,000 permanent jobs, as well as $1.5 billion in one-time construction output and over 8,000 one-time construction jobs. We also ran a mature industry scenario, assuming we were able to kind of achieve a tipping point where the technology develops on its own once we've given it an initial bump. And we do anticipate a much larger impact for a fully deployed mature industry with no further expenditure by the state. I'm happy to answer any additional questions would turn things over to Kathleen Schuler from Conservation Minnesota.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? If not, Ms. Schuler, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. I'm Kathleen Schuler. I work for Conservation Minnesota. I'm co-director of the Healthy Legacy Coalition, which is a statewide coalition dedicated to safe products made safely. We advocate for protective state policies and the reduction or use of toxic chemicals also through business leadership. We promote green chemistry as an upstream approach to protecting public health and the environment. Green chemistry reduces the generation of waste, it reduces energy use, but it also reduces or eliminates the use of toxic chemicals in processes and products, and often through the use of renewable feedstock. That's one of the principles of green chemistry, is to use renewable feedstock. There's an increasing demand for safer chemistry as manufacturers and retailers are seeking safer chemicals in their supply chains. These businesses recognize the value and the cost savings from reducing toxic inputs, including reduced liability, regulatory compliance, and meeting consumer demand for safer products. In Minnesota, we're lucky to have a cluster of businesses right here in our state that are currently meeting or are poised to meet in the future these growing business and consumer demands for safer chemistry. Companies like BioAmber, Sagetis, NatureWorks, Relucio, and others are utilizing biofeedstock to develop replacements for petroleum-derived plasticizers, solvents, and plastics. These are the nasty chemicals, and if we can replace them with safer chemistry, we're all going to benefit. Biochemicals provide a high-value use of agriculture and forestry feedstock that can help boost Minnesota's economy. So this bill provides a needed infusion of state support to keep existing green chemistry businesses in our state, to give them a reason to locate production facilities right here, and also to attract new businesses to our state to create new jobs. So SF-2101 provides a triple win for Minnesota. It benefits our economy, our environment, and our public health. Thanks for the opportunity to testify. I'd be happy to answer questions.
Thank you. Questions from the committee. Senator Weber.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Saxhaug, thank you for bringing this legislation forward. And just a couple of things. The first, I'm going to be very parochial, and it's because I have a plant that's already has converted to isobutanol production in my hometown. They're in the early stages, what have you. They obviously intend to expand, have greater production. With the start date of January 1st, 2015, does that keep that plant out of the running for any assistance in this legislation?
You know, the program is intended not just to help brand new facilities, but also to help facilities operating at a pilot scale to scale up.
Okay.
And we are working with that company in particular. So.
Okay.
Go ahead, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The other question I have is, as I look here and see that the Advanced biofuel facilities must produce at least 950 MMBTUs or 30 million pounds. As I understand, for example, isobutanol, you actually get it to a certain point where it's all the same. And then at some stage, if it's going to be fuels, you add something to make it fuels. If it's going to be chemical, you add something to go the chemical route. In light of the fact that the markets for each are perhaps somewhat or limited at this stage of the game, is there a way that they will have a capability of actually selling the pure isobutanol to both areas and have a combined scenario under which they will qualify for these payments?
Where some would be a renewable chemical and one would
right.
be part would be considered an advanced biofuel. We tried to set the incentive so it would be the sort of the same per pound, whether you're a fuel or a chemical.
Okay.
And actually, isobutanol is how we calculated that based on the example of isobutanol. You know, every chemical is going to be a little bit different, but we do try to not tip things one way or the other and reward both.
Senator Weber.
And because, thank you, Mr. Chair, because at some point these plants might be selling just the pure isobutanol
That's
out, right.
right?
Okay. And then if I might go one further, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead, keep going.
Okay, we have the combined. Oh, okay, then what I wanted to ask about was with the conversion. And I'm trying to struggle to going through my memory banks, and I don't quite come up with the number. If you are a licensed ethanol producer, and if you have the existing facilities and you have your total capacity that you have as ethanol, are you going to produce more or a lesser or a greater amount of isobutanol?
Mr. Chair, Senator Weber, I'm not sure I caught the whole question. I'm sorry.
Okay. As I understand, there's a limitation here that you cannot, if you have already received ethanol payments at some point. In the conversion process, you cannot get payments for the same gallons, the same capacity that you had previously. Now, in isobutanol, if I remember correctly, if you were a 15-million-gallon plant, you probably aren't going to be quite producing 15 million gallons of isobutanol. Am I correct in my recollection of that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Weber, it is our intention, and we feel it is justified to reward companies that, you know, sometimes an investment to move from ethanol to butanol production would involve significant new investment, upwards of $50 million into a facility. So we believe it is justified to, even if they have previously received an ethanol producer payment, to allow them to be part of this program.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to make sure, because if you read the language, it sounds like, well, if you aren't producing more than you were under ethanol, that you aren't going to qualify. So that's why I was wondering. Thank you.
Thank you.
And, Mr. Chair, you know, I think it's key to the whole program here that there's no subsidizing going on with this particular program. What we're trying to do is throw out a not insignificant amount of money, but it has to be leveraged many, many times more than the actual amount of money that we're going to be offering. So I think it's key that we aren't doing the subsidy here. We aren't, and we aren't going to start building plants. The money has to be. You're going to have to help me out here, Mr. Jordan, but basically we have to see the capital out there before we're going to
absolutely.
Put ours in. So.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee and Senator Saxhog, that's absolutely right. It is a production-based incentive, which means the state does not pay up front. So there isn't a risk that the state gives, for example, a grant to a project that ends up failing. It is a production-based incentive. The company needs to persuade their investors that they have good technology and a good project, and the state would not pay until the project were up and running and actually producing a product.
Is there further discussion? I had one question. That is, in terms of the industry, you have in your thing some other states and what they're doing, and how many of those are projects out there are biochemistry versus biofuels? and what do you expect? What are we going to see 10, 15 years from now?
Mr. Chair, what we have the most of in Minnesota is actually, in terms of the entrepreneurial startup cluster that I referred to, where we've had more than $200 million in venture capital, that's largely a chemical, renewable chemical cluster. They're making renewable materials, plastics, personal care products, a whole variety of other things. There is certainly, Minnesota has a long history with the ethanol industry, and in terms of advanced biofuels, we have a few projects in the state, but there are a lot of exciting things happening in other states. One of the exciting things that's happening is cellulosic ethanol, which is ethanol produced from biomass rather than the grain part of the crop, and really offers a lot of potential to continue moving the industry forward, reducing impact, and you know, I expect in the years to come, you'll see that industry continue to develop. You will see some projects come online this year in a few other states, including Iowa and Kansas. I've been to see some of them that are, you know, operating and are in the process of commissioning, fully constructed. I don't know if that answered your question, Mr. Chair.
I was just curious what you're expecting in terms of biochemistry versus it's faster growing but much smaller. Well, much smaller section.
And Mr. Chair, you know, our best example of biochemicals right now is the investment that Sappi made in their plant up in Cloquet. Easily done because they have the access to the wood and they also have a pulp plant. And so with those two things, making that transition to chemicals was relatively easy, and I think that's a production plant.
Senator Weber.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One last thing. It was my understanding, and I haven't had an opportunity to compare language in the bills, it was my understanding that there was a discussion between you and one of the commodity groups as it pertained to certain language. Does the bill that we have in front of us today reflect the agreement that you've reached with them?
Mr. Chair, Senator Weber, yes, it does.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Further discussion? If not, we'll be resuming, coming back to this bill later. So, okay. Thank you, Mr. Senator Sachs.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, we'll look forward to seeing you in the near future.
With that, Senator Skoy is here. You're in the, what?
How come you didn't do anything?
Sure. I knew that.
Welcome to the committee. Senator Skoy, sent file 2477.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And let me just give you a little bit of background of what I've been thinking about and working on for the last number of months. Most of you know that Minnesota experienced a pretty significant propane shortage this last fall and winter. Prices went from $1.30 to $4.30 or higher. And for many of our rural residents, propane is the backup heating source that they have when they use electric with their off-peak system or their rippling system. It really was a hardship in a number of areas. Also, grain drying facilities were struggling to get propane to their facilities. We had one situation that I know of where corn was unable to be dried. We couldn't get rail cars in. They had to put it on the ground, and we had a significant amount of loss. So this kind of started to be some pretty serious discussions about what we're going to do in Minnesota with regard to propane. There is another issue coming about with regard to propane, and that is that the pipeline that delivers 40% of the propane into the state on the western part is going to be turned around and will not be delivering propane next year. So from a usage or from a supply side, we are going to have a larger challenge next year than we have this year. So that leads into a meeting that I attended middle of last fall or maybe even early this winter, and we were having conversations about perhaps the probability of a pipeline coming in from North Dakota into western Minnesota. evidently, if you go through the Bakken oil fields currently, there's lots of flaring of natural gas going on. There's millions of cubic feet of natural gas just being burned off. Those wells have lost their permits to continue to dispose of natural gas in that manner. So they are very seriously trying to find uses for natural gas. And one of the ways they're looking at using it is to build a fertilizer plant in Fargo. From the conversations I've had with some of the North Dakota legislators and others that I know, their preferred option would be to put a pipeline across North Dakota and come into Minnesota and sell natural gas. So I look at the propane shortage and I look at the natural gas available, and I think, is there any way that we can put these two things together? I spent a fair amount of time talking to our rural utilities folks, the REAs and others. I've talked to the pipeline folks that pull natural gas lines in around the state, trying to find, you know, what are the roadblocks to more utilization of natural gas. One of the things that occurred in the community that I live in is Bagley, Fauston, and Clearbrook ended up getting a T on the natural gas line that goes through. It's relatively involved to tap into these high-pressure lines. You have to liquefy the gas to measure it. You have to reduce the pressure so you can put it in these less strong lines. And it's a pretty complicated deal. But because those three communities banded together and there happened to be a couple of industries that were pretty large users of propane, the utilization was high enough that the economics were there. So we brought natural gas into the town of Clearbrook, Fauston, Bagley, the school, the nursing home, and the egg processing plants were there, utilized it also. Was a real good move, and I kept thinking, well, why can't we do this in western Minnesota for these grain drying facilities that are currently running on propane? They would then be using natural gas, which would free up a supply of propane for other more remote and smaller users to use. I didn't really come up with any solid answers on how to get this done. I think at the federal level, they actually changed the name and some of the mission from the old REA, the Rural Electric Association, that did such a good job of electrifying the rural parts of our country. They've changed the name to the Rural Utility Service, trying to broaden their scope. Now, in that broadening, they weren't anticipating natural gas. They were thinking more of communications and broadband and that type of technologies. But it seems to me that there must be some mechanism available to utilize this low-cost, clean-burning, available source of natural gas that's right at our west, that will be right at our western border. So what I'd like to do is to have the Legislative Energy Commission take a little look at this specific problem, try to do a little research into are some of the roadblocks from teeing off the existing natural gas lines, or perhaps bringing another natural gas line into the state and then supplying natural gas to the larger propane users, which would free up propane for individual homes and other smaller users to utilize. And it will, if you listen to the propane debate, there's going to be a fair amount of money spent on infrastructure, storage tanks, shipping facilities, et cetera. I think this should be in the mix is really a preferable outcome over the long haul if we're able to accomplish it. And I was asking this group to study that.
Thank you, Senator Scott. And I think it is an appropriate thing for the group to study. The one thing I was going to say is the technical and economic issues may be somewhat beyond. I mean, I think we can talk about in the commission how to try and get as much as we can, but I don't think the LEC has the – I mean, what we can do is – talk with people, bring experts together perhaps and find out something, but because I think this is a important issue and I understand the timeliness of it. Can I ask how many of, like, in your among your constituency, do you have any clue what percentage would be using propane right now that might be, I mean, depending on in communities that might be easier to connect to natural gas infrastructure, which is, as you know, a huge
You know, I don't know how many communities are on natural gas. I think in the more rural areas, it's pretty few.
Right.
Now, Bemidji is. I don't represent Bemidji. But those size of facilities probably do have natural gas because of the concentrations. The reason that I think some of these communities would have an opportunity to connect is if there was a grain drying facility that was closer within their jurisdiction that would be a pretty high volume user, and that would get the utilization up enough to be able to afford the T, and then they can run the lines to the houses. From the understanding I have from discussions with the folks in Clearbrook, Bagley, and Fauston that worked on this, this teeing off the high pressure distribution lines that are really the that's really the most expensive part of it. They don't, you know, going between Bagley and Fauston, they just used a 2-inch plastic line. And, you know, it's not a big deal. And I was really surprised when I saw it, but they showed up with rolls of plastic line, and that's what the gas is running in from what I could see.
I have a little fear of high-pressure gas running through little plastic lines, but I can understand. I don't know anything about the technology or anything. Senator Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess I'm not against pipelines, but last year this body put into policy that Minnesota would be the first state in the nation to go 100% renewable. This bill is very narrowly focused on one fossil fuel to another fossil fuel, and I'm wondering why the LEC would study fossil fuels when we've put into goal going 100% renewable. I'm thinking it would make sense, if we hear this in the LEC, to not just look at propane to natural gas, but broaden it out to solar and wind and the feasibility of those types of things. I didn't agree with that policy change, but it's put into law. So to me, it seems like it would make sense to broaden this bill if that's the direction the state is going.
Senator Brown is one who does support that change in direction that we do have in law. Let me comment on two things about this, one of which is I think natural gas is in the short term going to be a big role. And right now, one of the things when you're looking at the technical and economic issues is we'd be requesting the commission to look at here, the economics of something that 20 years from now, 30 years from now, we may not be doing anymore. Things are constantly changing, and I think right now we've got natural gas when it's being flared off right now, as Senator Scoy pointed out, that is it's a much less costly fuel if you can get it to people than the propane they're burning now. Whether this is feasible, I think, is a big question because of the amount of infrastructure you need and the fact that I think the reality is not just Minnesota, but others are going to be moving away from fossil fuels. So I think that right now we've got people who are paying, you've seen the prices they're paying and everything else, and we've got natural gas being flared off, and if we can use it in a way, I think it's very appropriate to look at it. But yes, I don't think the commission is interested only in looking at this. I think the commission is very much interested in looking at a whole range of things. It's a very good point you're raising. I agree with you. Senator Scoy and then Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to Senator Brown's question. I think that the commission has an ongoing role in looking at renewable resources. I'm asking for a relatively small look at this. We weren't talking about a lot of money. I think that, you know, this might be under $10,000 for them to take a little look at that. They do have a small amount of money in their funds. As you'll notice on pages line 7, I have is requesting. I had thought about putting some stronger language in there requiring them, but I chose not to do that because I understand that their financial wherewithal. But I think it's a relatively small request. I'm hoping they can work it into their current funding and come up with an answer to this specific question while they're working on these larger energy issues that they're bound to be working on.
Well stated, Senator Scoy. That's what I was trying to say. In terms of the big picture, this may be shorter term and it may, but it has some potential here, I think. Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Squigg. The LEC is always looking for something to work on, and I think this is
a little
something that we'll have a chance to. But I'm just thinking of the resources that it's going to take, not just necessarily money, but the amount of experts it's going to take to bring in to talk about and nail this down. Because when you start talking, for example, I'm just thinking of all the questions that are going to come up with this. Who's going to be liable? And who's going to pay for the expenses of hooking onto that pipeline? Is it going to be the homeowner? Will it be their expense? Or will it be? So it's where's the liability fall? There's right now we have the propane companies, and it's their liability. So it's a whole set of new issues with this.
Mr. Chair and Senator Rosen, that'll have to be part of what their discussion is. My understanding is currently the utility is responsible to the meter, and I think the homeowner has responsibility after the meter. I think most of the meters are on the side of the house, so you kind of get a feel for where the responsibility is from that. But, yeah, no, it's an issue that I don't – to be honest, I thought I was going to be able to get some answers. My initial run at this was that I was going to draft some legislation to address the barriers from bringing natural gas to these grain drying facilities. After numerous conversations, it became apparent that we needed a little higher level look at this to just try to, talk to the utilities folks and to the pipeline folks and see if they can come up with some. I personally think it's most of a finance barrier, but there might be some supply issues, too, that would have to be addressed, and they could take a little higher-level look at it. And from that, then I could start, narrowing down to what some of the options are that I might have.
Senator Squire, I think you explained pretty well. I mean, the end result of a LEC look into this is not going to be, okay, here's the proposal and this is how it could be funded and everything. You're not going to get that, but you'll get, as you said, the next step one up from where you are. And if there's some potential here, this may point the direction to it. So, so anyway, Senator Eaton, want to move legislation?
So moved.
Senator Eaton moves it. Senate File 2477 be recommended to pass, and it would not go anywhere else. Further discussion on that? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Aye.
Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Senator Fischbach. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Senate File 455, I believe it is, was through this committee last year, and it went to the floor, and then we never got to deal with it on general orders. Basically, it's a very simple bill. All it does is removes the preferred from the preferred route when they're looking at siting a new transmission line. Because right now what happens is, for example, CapEx 2020 comes with a preferred route. And in our experience with the routing a few years ago, it kind of lulled people into a feeling that, oh, well, we're not on the preferred route. We don't have to worry about this. And so and it ended up not being the preferred route in a lot of the cases. So the folks were kind of caught off guard. And so we felt like just removing that preferred would make people pay attention and make sure that they're looking at it and really following the entire conversation and the entire process. I understand, Mr. Chair, if you would, there's a technical amendment that Mr. Fuller had regarding the enactment date.
Senator Coonan moves the A1 amendment, which I believe is in our packets. Is there any discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Is there further discussion on the bill? Is there anybody who wishes to comment on the bill? Seeing no further discussion, Senator Coonan, okay. Senator Rosen moves that Senate File 455 as amended be recommended to pass once again. On that motion, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members.
Obviously. I think the next one is me.
You can do one more.
One. Chair again. You don't mind?
Okay, committee. Senator Marty's Senate file 2448 is before us. Senator Marty.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you. The Senate file 2448 is one of the unsessioned bills eliminating, as you can see by the title, antiquated, unnecessary, redundant, obsolete laws. Last night I was in Health and Human Services Committee, and one of the bills they took up was deleting a long, outdated provision that I was the original author of, and I thought, uh-oh. It related to telephone devices for the deaf, TDD machines, which one point was really important. And anyway, so we'll go ahead and see at it. So if
Mr.
anybody,
Chair, Mr. Chair.
Yeah,
I'd like to ask Senator Marty, did you fall under unnecessary, redundant, obsolete, or antiquated?
Probably several of those. Okay. And Mr. Chair, I have an A1 amendment that I don't know if this came from Mr. Grant or from Senate Counsel or where, but I'll move that to put the bill in the shape that I desire, I guess.
Okay, so this is an author's amendment.
Yes.
Okay. Senator Marty moves the A1 amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted.
And, Mr. Chair, I'm going to have Mr. Grant go through the bill and explain what we're taking out and why.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Bill Grant for the Department of Commerce, Division of Energy Resources, here today to provide testimony about the department's energy unsession bill. As you're aware, the unsession, a first-of-its-kind effort to make state government better, faster, simpler, and more efficient for people. Department of Commerce wants to improve government services, eliminate old and outdated rules, and undo anything else that makes government nearly impossible for people to understand, all of us accepted, of course. The Commerce Department took this challenge very seriously and tackled the 112 chapters of law and 54 chapters of rules and over 2,000 pages under its authority. On behalf of the department, I would like to point out that Commerce has the most pages of law of any state agency. Total is nearly 3,000 pages. 2,000 in chapters of law and 760 pages of rules. So luckily for this committee, the bulk of those pages and subsequent unsession proposals actually belong under the department or under the Commerce Committee's jurisdiction, not this committee's jurisdiction. The process we followed in reviewing all of the pages of our authority was very comprehensive. We met division by division, working with our staff to analyze the statutes and rules. And we categorized our recommendations in one of four ways. First, by condensing a section by eliminating some language in that section. Second, by consolidating a section with another section of statute or rule, repealing a section in its entirety, or keeping a section as is with no changes. So the components of this bill are Section 1. The bill eliminates an obsolete sentence in 216.03 related to a state government energy savings plan that is no longer in operation. In Section 2, the language deletes a reference to 216.263 that is being repealed in the repealer section. Under the repealers, we're repealing 216C.262, the optimal low-income weatherization program, This was a program back in the day with the University of Minnesota, the Building Energy Research Center, for the purpose of determining optimal weatherization for low-income programs. That program ran its course, made its findings, and is now obsolete. Next section is 216C.263, oil overcharge money for energy conservation. The appropriation for this was expended in the 1980s and is therefore now obsolete. 216C.373, the super insulated home demonstration project. Again, a project that was completed in the 1980s with one-time funds, therefore is now obsolete. 216C.38, the aforementioned Building Energy Research Center, has been replaced now with the Center for Sustainable Buildings at the University of Minnesota, so is no longer in existence and it's in the statutory form. And then 216C.44, the Business Energy Use Accountability Program, we're eliminating an unused form. No municipalities have requested it. The amendment that was added to the bill deletes a number of obsolete rules, one related to decorative gas lamps, the second related to an energy conservation financing program for a program that no longer exists. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to answer any questions the committee has.
Okay. Any questions for Mr. Grant from committee members? Okay, I guess not. So, Senator Marty.
Mr. Chair, before moving the bill, I'll point out that the oil overcharge provision was one I authored and actually was vetoed by Governor Perpich, and I think the legislature overrode that veto, actually. Or who would determine how the money was spent. But and that is clearly an antiquated one because that was 25 years ago the money's been gone. Anyway, I will move that Senate File 2488 be recommended to pass.
Okay, Senator Marty moves Senate File 2448 as amended to pass. Where is it? To the
floor.
To the floor, okay. All in favor, aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries.
And, Mr. Chair, as I mentioned earlier, Senator Dibble's bill will be heard, I think, next week. People were raising concerns about that at the last minute. I think we'd be better to prepare for that. So with that, I think we're done with the agenda then.
Okay. Anything further, committee members?
Game and the Fish and Wildlife Subcommittee will meet at 3.
Oh, okay.
Mr. Chair, if I could just announce that.
Yes,
that,
Senator Schmidt.
Game and Fish Subcommittee will be meeting today at 3 p.m. in this room right here. So thank you all.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, Senator Schmidt, are you going to be finishing the agenda today or not?
Yeah, we will be marking up the bill and passing out the bill that will hopefully come before this committee next week.
Must be.
Okay. Anything else? All right, we're adjourned.